Everyone learns a language for different reasons. Maybe you want to watch K-dramas without subtitles or talk with family members in their native language. Your life is unique. Your language learning should be too. Rosetta Stone, the trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years, just launched Rosetta Stone Sapphire, a new app that combines its proven immersion method with the latest innovation and technology to help you learn faster, personalize your lessons, and have more fun along the way. Most language apps teach the same generic topics. Sapphire helps you focus on what you actually want to talk about, whether that's travel, family, work, or your favorite hobbies. If you want to take your language skills to the next level, don't wait to try Rosetta Stone Sapphire. Listeners can get 20% off their Rosetta Stone Sapphire subscription when they sign up today. You'll get unlimited access to all 25 Rosetta Stone languages, plus all the new Sapphire learning tools. Visit rosettastone.com/audio to redeem your 20% off. That's rosettastone.com/audio and start learning a language for real.
June is here, which means it's finally time to reach for your summer wardrobe. And if you're trying to look good without overheating, Quince is your best bet. Their summer collection has all the warm weather staples, breathable linen, washable silk, and soft organic cotton. I now own their 100% linen pants in more colors than I'd like to admit. And the best part is that you get all that quality without the luxury markup. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince works directly with ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not brand markup. And it's not just clothing. Quince has become a destination for elevated essentials across the home, from kitchen to bedding, making it easy to bring a more premium feel into everyday life. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/campus for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/campus for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/campus. One afternoon in the late 1970s, a Yale employee noticed a locked door in the gym. He was curious, so he opened it. The room looked like it hadn't been touched for decades. Inside, he found boxes, stacks of them. And inside those boxes, photographs. Thousands of photographs of naked young men, shot from the front, side, and profiles. The employee didn't know what to make of it, so he brought the athletic director down to see. The director didn't know either. But after some digging, they realized they'd uncovered the remnants of a strange chapter of Yale's history. And they acted quickly. Every photograph was shredded. Then, for extra precaution, the shreds were burned, all to ensure that no recognizable images of these Yale students would survive. They wanted to make it all disappear, but that history wouldn't stay hidden for long. I'm Margot Gray. This week on Campus Files, the forgotten history of poster photos on America's college campuses.
I grew up in Fargo, North Dakota, and you will never find a place more homogeneous or more boringly normal than Fargo.
This is Richard Seneschal. By his senior year of high school in 1965, he was more than ready to leave his hometown of Fargo, North Dakota behind. He had the credentials. He was a National Merit Scholar, top of his class. But that didn't make the college application process any less daunting.
When it came time to think about going to college, I didn't really have any help. My parents were supportive, but they had really no knowledge or any ability to assist me. So I was doing this entire process by myself.
But Richard did just fine on his own. He applied to 7 Ivy League schools in Stanford and got into all of them. He ended up picking Yale. He wanted to be an architect, and a brand new Yale building had just graced the cover of Time magazine. So in September 1965, he and his dad packed up the car and drove east to New Haven, Connecticut. 2 days and 1,500 miles later, Richard and his dad arrived at Yale. It was one of those perfect early fall days. The leaves just starting to change color.
I'd never seen the campus, and other than a few pictures in Yale promotional materials, didn't really know what it looked like. And there wasn't anything grand in Fargo at all. The tallest building in Fargo was 6 stories. So everything, when I hit the campus, I went, my God, this is gorgeous. And I was just stunned.
It wasn't only the beauty of the campus that surprised him. From the start, Richard says he felt like a stranger in a strange land.
I knew nothing about the East Coast, nothing about New England. I mean, North Dakota is as far from Yale as you can possibly get.
For starters, Richard was confused why so many of his classmates somehow knew each other already. He discovered that many of them, the preppies as he calls them, had come from the same small circle of elite prep schools. And then there was the uniform. Yale had instructed freshmen to wear a coat and tie to class, so Richard had dutifully purchased a whole new wardrobe. But when he showed up, he learned there was an unspoken memo. Everyone actually wore tweed jackets with elbow patches and a deliberately rumpled tie.
There wasn't a thing that happened on any given day that wasn't outside of my experience.
But one thing in particular felt completely outside his experience. It began when he got instructions to report to Yale's main gymnasium, Payne Whitney.
It's a massive high-rise building with multiple indoor pools and indoor running tracks and weight rooms and bunches of locker rooms. And, you know, we call Payne Whitney the Cathedrale de Sport, because if you've seen the building, it's a high-rise Gothic building that could easily pass for a French cathedral.
Richard learned that he'd have to go through a whole series of tests, starting with a fitness assessment. And he was nervous. He wasn't exactly the athletic type.
And as it turns out, I passed the sit-up and push-up part of the fitness test, but I failed the pull-up part, and so was assigned to 6 weeks of remedial exercise until I could do the requisite number of pull-ups.
This portion of the evaluation didn't surprise Richard. He'd had his share of sit-up and pull-up tests in high school, but the next part did. They were going to evaluate his posture.
I recall being shuffled into a locker room and told to strip nude. Now, that in itself was not immediately troublesome, because at my high school, the boys swam nude in gym.
Yes, you heard that right. Until the 1970s, nude swimming was standard for high school boys across much of the country. In fact, the American Public Health Association formally recommended nude swimming as part of good pool management.
So I thought, well, okay. But then I walked into this windowless room, and there were 3 gnomish little old men there.
2 of the men stood off to the side, observing. The 3rd motioned for him to step onto a platform.
While I stood there, took a grease pencil and felt all over my body looking for the bone points, the point at which various joints and bones were closest to the surface. Shoulders, shoulder blades, vertebrae, hip bones, joints, knees, elbows, whatever, and marked each of those spots with a black grease pencil. I can still feel that little old man's fingertips prodding my body, looking for spots to put the black marker. That was a very strange experience.
There were a few mirrors positioned around him, so one photograph captured 3 angles, front, back, and profile. Richard stood still as the camera flashed.
By this point, it was pretty disturbing. But, you know, again, everything was new and different for me. I just assumed, well, this is the way they do it on the East Coast. And it was just me that was not in tune with the reality of this grand Ivy League institution.
But when Richard got back to his dorm, he started talking about the photos with some of the guys on his hall. And it turned out he wasn't the only person who'd found it weird.
As it happened, the guys in the suite next to mine had also been to public high schools, and we were sort of comparing notes going, boy, was that weird. And that's about the first time that it really sunk in how strange and invasive that posture evaluation had been. Now, I think it may not have been as big a surprise to the preppies, who had older brothers who'd gone to Yale, whose fathers had gone to Yale, who knew the culture and probably went, yeah, ho-hum, right?
Richard's hunch is right. I talked to several alumni whose fathers or older brothers had also gone to Yale, the preppies, as Richard likes to call them. and they'd all heard about the posture photos before they arrived on campus. Some had actually been coached on how to pose, so they'd be more likely to pass the posture evaluation. But even for the preppies, knowing what was coming didn't make it any less unsettling. And yet everyone went along with it. No one I spoke to could recall a single student objecting to the photos.
Times were very different. You know, we were straight arrow kids. We grew up in church and home and school. We were taught to follow rules and to do what your elders told you. And nobody had started rebellion. The 60s that you think of as the 60s didn't start until probably about 67, when suddenly the Vietnam War really triggered a whole social change and activism and what have you. Nobody would have said, no, not going to do that. Just was not. We didn't start saying no until about 67, when it was a question of life or death.
And it wasn't just Yale students who went along with this. From the 1940s through the 1960s, posture evaluations were standard practice at colleges and universities across the country. We're talking tens of thousands of photographs of nude freshmen stored in university archives. Personally, I'd never heard of any of this before researching this episode. And the more I learned, the more questions I had. The first being, why did schools care about their students' posture in the first place?
Hey parents, we all know summer break is for fun, but it's also a time when kids can start losing some of the progress they made during the school year. We want them to stay engaged and keep those young minds active. Between camps, vacations, and family time, it can be tough to keep a learning routine going. That's why I want to tell you about IXL. IXL is an award-winning online learning platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts, from pre-K through 12th grade, IXL offers personalized interactive learning that adapts to each child's level and pace. It's an easy way to keep learning going through the summer and helps kids feel confident heading into the next school year. Studies show kids who use IXL score higher on tests, proven in all 50 states. And get this, IXL is used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. That's a huge endorsement. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLLearning.com/audio. Visit IXLLearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Isn't it crazy that America is turning 250 years old? I mean, look how far we've come. Now, we've got coolers in our sofas, light-up cup holders, and power-articulating headrests. When it comes to furniture worthy of this major milestone, Bob's Discount Furniture has all the styles all of America wants at the everyday low prices we deserve, backed by tons of five-star reviews. Check out the Sedona Power Reclining Sofa, a genuine leather one-stop shop for relaxation with built-in charging, cup holders, and supportive bobopedic seats, perfect for lounging in the AC all day. You can even complete the look with the matching love seat and recliner. Throwing summer parties? The Homeworks dining set features comfy bobopedic seating and clever storage built right into the table and bench. Or customize your space with the customer favorite modular Bob sectional. It has over 1,000 five-star reviews, family-proof construction, and wireless charging for hundreds less than the competition. At only $250 per piece, building your dream sectional is incredibly affordable. Celebrate the 4th at Bob's. It's where America shops for furniture.
From today's perspective, Richard's freshman orientation at Yale was, well, strange. Even the fitness test part of it. Imagine showing up to college and getting tested on pull-ups, push-ups, and sit-ups. Why did Yale care? Here's how Richard explains it.
Yale in the 60s was dedicated to raising the next 1,000 male leaders. It was an all-male institution. It was directed at creating the next round of politicians and bank presidents and famous lawyers and doctors. And so this was just part of an overall training to make you into that mold.
I still don't know why my future doctor or lawyer needs to do pull-ups, but I get the idea. Yale wanted the next generation of American leaders to be physically fit. What I can't understand is why posture mattered so much. So much so that students were tested on it and had to take classes if they failed. So I reached out to a historian for answers, Dr. Beth Linker.
I'm a professor in the history and sociology of science at the University of Pennsylvania. And I'm the author most recently of the book Slouch, Posture, Panic in Modern America.
Dr. Linker wasn't planning on writing a book about posture. She stumbled on the topic while doing research for another book at the National Archives in Washington, D.C.
I was looking at World War I. I was looking at the birth of rehabilitation as a form of aftercare for disabled soldiers. So I opened this box and it was just a bunch of tracing paper with footprints on it. And I was like, what is this?
It turned out that those footprints belonged to World War I draftees. The military had taken them as part of the medical screening process. At the time, flat feet were considered a disability. Men with low arches were routinely rejected from military service. And flat feet weren't the only thing that could disqualify you from joining the army. A posture defect could too.
It could be asymmetrical shoulders. It could be leg length difference. It could be swayed back. It could be hunched over. Something called pigeon chest, which was kind of a concave chest. So all of those things could have fallen under a postural defect.
So you could be rejected from the draft simply for having bad posture, and not because the Army cared about how commanding you looked in a uniform, but because of a widely accepted idea at the time, that posture was tied to overall health.
Poor posture may be a sign of something wrong with you. You may be run down physically, or overtired, or upset. You need a thorough checkup by your family doctor to discover the cause of your posture defects.
The belief was that slouching didn't just look bad. It made you physically weaker and more susceptible to illness.
If you usually slump, the health of the whole body is affected. Our skeletons and muscles are designed to support our vital organs so that they can do their best work. If we sag, these organs are pushed out of their proper positions.
In medical theory, at this time in the early 20th century, they start to make links between poor posture and one of the greatest killers of the day, tuberculosis. And what they argue is that if somebody has a slouching or slumping posture, their breathing and respiratory capacity is compromised, and therefore slouching would lead to tuberculosis.
It became a national public health campaign. Posters went up in schools, doctors' offices, factories. One poster read, "Poor posture encourages tuberculosis. Erect carriage combats it."
What is good posture? How can you make it a habit? Like a lot of boys and girls, your posture is your problem. What are you going to do about it?
This wasn't fringe thinking. It was being promoted by academics at some of the most elite campuses in the country. There was even an organization called the American Posture League that was made up largely of Ivy League professors. At Yale, one prominent professor blamed his own tuberculosis on his hunched back. And at Harvard in 1917, a physician led the first large-scale systematic study of posture. It was called the Harvard Slouch Study.
The Harvard Slouch Study was the only posture that counted as good posture was this like perfect plumb line vertical posture. So he found that 80% of Harvard students had poor posture.
The Harvard Slouch Study helped spark a full-blown posture obsession on college campuses. And that obsession outlasted the threat of tuberculosis. Even after antibiotics became widely available in the mid-1940s, the focus on posture didn't fade. The thinking around it just changed.
The infectious disease part kind of went away and instead morphs into this concern about bad posture is bad for more chronic conditions, so cardiac conditions, diabetes, obesity.
In other words, good posture became something of a shorthand for being physically fit. And in the mid-20th century, physical fitness mattered a lot. The country had just survived two world wars and was now heading into the Cold War. National strength and military readiness were being talked about in terms of physical preparedness.
Are you ready physically for this training? Your body's got to be able to take it, because service means new physical demands on strength and endurance. That's why in military training,
can't afford to kind of become flabby, and we need to keep our bodies hardened for any future wars. So especially for men, but for women, about kind of birthing the next generation of fit Americans.
Universities had a crucial role to play. They were raising the future leaders of the free world, leaders who needed to be physically prepared. So in the 50s and 60s, physical fitness tests became routine on college campuses, built into orientation programs, PE classes, medical screenings for incoming students. And posture exams became a key part of those tests at schools across the country. The exact nature of the posture exams differed from campus to campus and year to year. At some places, an examiner simply looked you up and down and took notes. Other campuses used tools like the schematograph, a device that allowed examiners to manually trace a student's silhouette.
Eventually, camera photography would win out, partly because it was cheaper as the 20th century progressed, and also it was seen as more scientific because tracing is done by the human hand. And so that looks a little bit more backward, a little bit less modern, not as hardcore scientific.
In most cases, students pose nude for these posture photographs. Maybe if they were lucky, in a bathing suit or halter top. The camera captured every angle, front, back, profile. Examiners then scrutinized the images. And at most schools, if your posture didn't meet the ideal standard, you were sent to corrective classes.
A student would work on crawling and walking and standing and perfecting their posture. And for some students, this was 2 years of physical education.
Remember Richard? He ended up failing his posture exam, so he had to take these classes during his freshman year at Yale. He can't recall exactly how long the program lasted, but he's certain it stretched on for at least several weeks. Once he finished, though, he says he more or less forgot about the whole thing.
It just sort of disappeared from memory. There was so much more going on. You can imagine the change in your life at 17, where you go far away from home and enter a completely foreign environment, and everything takes an adjustment. That one occurrence kind of drifted into the past pretty quickly.
Richard didn't think about those posture photos for decades. Then something made him remember and begin to rethink everything.
Are you really buying a car online on AutoTrader right now?
Really? I can get super specific with dealer listings and see cars based on my budget.
Mom!
You can really have it delivered.
Or pick it up.
Mommy, look!
I think your kid is walking up the slide.
Really?
AutoTrader. Buy your car online. Really?
What does leadership really look like? On The Power of Advice, a new podcast series from Capital Group, you'll hear from athletes, entrepreneurs, and executives who've led on the field, in the boardroom, and in their communities. It's not about titles. It's about impact. Discover what drives them and the advice they carry forward. Subscribe and start listening today. Published by Capital Client Group, Inc.
By the 1960s, posture photography had become standard practice at universities across the country.
These posture exams are happening in historically black colleges. They happened in a lot of state universities. This was not just an Ivy League phenomenon.
Thousands of students were photographed naked each year. At Yale, that included George Bush and Bob Woodward. At Wellesley, Hillary Clinton and Diane Sawyer. At Vassar, Meryl Streep. At most schools, a majority of freshmen failed the test. They were told that they had posture problems and needed to take remedial classes. So, for countless American college students, these posture classes became something of a rite of passage. But the whole practice was living on borrowed time. By the end of the 1960s, posture photographs were on their way out. In fact, by the time Richard graduated from Yale in 1969, freshmen were no longer subjected to these photographs. So what happened? Dr. Linker says that there wasn't a single moment that ended it. Instead, a handful of forces quietly converged. One of them was the feminist movement.
A new movement for women's liberation is launched, and once again, protesters take to the street to support their demands for total freedom, economically, politically, socially.
Remember, the feminist movement is already having protests at the Miss America contest.
Inside, one set of young women accepted the chauvinist baubles. Outside, others carried on with more consciousness raising.
We have bra burning, we have all of that going on. And there's just no way that, especially at these all-women's colleges, that anybody is going to stand for a posture exam.
At Cornell University, a group of female students staged a quiet rebellion. They stole a stack of the posture photos and then pinned the blame on the men. The administration looked pretty incompetent, unable to protect its students. And not long after, the entire posture program was shut down there.
The other thing that stops the posture photos is that this is the beginning of the disability rights movement, and people with severe disabilities successfully gaining access for the first time to higher education.
A handicapped demand that Section 504 of the Civil Rights Act be signed. It guarantees the rights of the handicapped in education and employment.
So you have a lot of post-polio people with polio who are wheelchair users who fight against physical education mandates.
Another major factor was the passage of FERPA in 1974, the Family Educational Rights and Protection Act. Students got sweeping new privacy protections, and suddenly universities had to rethink what kinds of records they kept and who had access to them.
All of these things come together to make it so that something like a practice of taking nude photographs of university students and keeping a record of these nude photographs seemed anathema to the spirit of the times.
So schools quietly stopped the practice. No more nude photography. But they were still left with decades worth of the negatives sitting in storage. And so began another quiet operation, disposal. Many schools began destroying the images.
And one reason for that was that a lot of colleges are not going to have the money to put these photographs in archival holdings. So they're not going to do that. The other thing is that they had a suspicion, especially with FERPA, that it wasn't going to look too good if these photographs got in the wrong hands.
But it wasn't as simple as just getting rid of the photos. At some schools, like Smith College, there were years-long debates. Archivists wanted to keep them, arguing they could protect alumni's privacy by restricting access to the photos for a few decades. But university PR and legal counsel were adamant, destroy the photos. And generally, they won. At all of these schools, the alumni, the people actually in the photos, weren't part of the conversations. Most of the alumni assumed the photos were long gone, if they thought about them at all. Which is why a New York Times article set off such outrage. In 1995, reporter Ron Rosenbaum published a piece called The Great Ivy League Nude Posture Photo Scandal. Rosenbaum knew the subject firsthand. He'd had his own posture photo taken as a freshman at Yale in the 1960s. What he revealed in the article was damning. First, those photos hadn't just been sitting in boxes all those years. Some of them had made their way to a highly controversial psychologist, William H. Sheldon.
Sheldon had interest in looking at external physical attributes, thinking that those certain physical attributes can tell you something about a person's inner thoughts, characteristics, and psychology.
Sheldon developed a theory called somatotyping. It was basically a numbering system that sorted people into three body types: endomorphs, ectomorphs, and mesomorphs. Sheldon believed these body types told you just about everything about a person: their intelligence, their character, their criminality. Someone who was linear or angular, for example, was considered more likely to be homosexual. someone who was rounder, was considered more likely to be lazy and undisciplined. To prove his theory, Sheldon needed photos, lots of them.
Dr. Sheldon, can you explain why we have to have a somatotype photograph?
So we based the whole early work on somatotyping on the process of photographing many thousands of different growing boys and girls and college students.
Sheldon was taking plenty of photos on his own, but he was also pursuing another source, the posture photographs that universities had been taking for years.
It didn't strike me that it was that difficult for him to get access to these photos. He just simply wrote letters to other professors on university campuses, and they would just send him the negatives or the prints.
We don't know exactly how many images Sheldon got his hands on, but we do know this. His 1954 book, The Atlas of Men, includes no shortage of photos of Harvard freshmen. Then there was Rosenbaum's second bombshell. He discovered that contrary to what alumni believed, many of these photos still existed. Yes, most universities had quietly destroyed their archives years ago, but thousands of images were still sitting in William Sheldon's personal collection, housed in the National Anthropological Archives at the Smithsonian. Rosenbaum eventually got access to the boxes, and inside, he found perfectly preserved negatives of nude freshmen, some still labeled with ages, height, weight, names. Entire graduating classes were in there. Yale class of 1950, 63, 64, 66, 71. Princeton class of 1952. Penn class of 1951. The list went on. When alumni found out about this, they were furious, and they didn't stay quiet.
Archivists were just inundated with irate alumni that these photos still existed. And so they were ordered by general counsel at their universities and administrators to travel to the Smithsonian to incinerate any evidence of photographs from their particular institution.
Until this whole saga resurfaced, Richard hadn't given these photos any thought, let alone wondered where his might have ended up.
That would be kind of embarrassing to have out there, but maybe less so for me than some of my other compatriots. I mean, George W. Bush was a class ahead of me at Yale, and I'm sure went through the same thing as his dad probably did in the 40s. And talk about embarrassing. Think about posture pictures floating around for public figures. So I hope they were destroyed. That's all I can say. Although nowadays, I might be glad to see how young and fit I was at that age.
When I started working on this story, I figured it would be hard to find sources. Anyone who'd had their posture photo taken would likely be in their 80s or 90s by now, meaning they probably weren't online. So I submitted a letter to Yale's alumni magazine explaining what I was working on and asking anyone with memories of the posture photos to reach out. I expected one, maybe two responses, three at most. But over the next few weeks, dozens of messages came in from Yale graduates, many saying the same thing, that they hadn't thought about those posture photos in decades. But yes, of course they remembered. One email stood out. It was from Ivan Berger. He was Yale class of 1961.
I grew up in Naugatuck, Connecticut, about 20 miles from Yale. I went to, I think, a somewhat subpar grammar school, and it was obvious early in first grade that I was going to be the valedictorian.
Ivan had the scores to get into Yale, but he worried about the price tag of tuition. In the end, he got a scholarship. It came with a condition, though. He'd have to work for the school.
Like my freshman year, I was a busboy in Commons. Now, Commons was the freshman dining room. Being a busboy in Commons is a bit like feeding the wolves.
By sophomore year, Ivan was hoping to find a different job. And as luck would have it, there was a new job opening that involved one of his hobbies, photography.
In high school, I shot a hell of a lot of pictures. And I also had my own darkroom and a very, very small business taking pictures for people.
So Ivan signed up for the photography job, but it was not at all what he was expecting. He wouldn't be taking yearbook photos or snapping action shots of college athletes. He'd be taking nude posture photos of the incoming freshmen.
We had to work it around my class schedule, so I would probably do an hour or two a day. It was just position the subject, click the button, four strobe lights go off at once. Next. It could be 100 in a day.
Ivan's job didn't end once the photos were taken. He was also responsible for developing the prints, hundreds of nude posture photos.
This is very, very boring if you are a straight guy. I suspect it would become boring after 10 minutes if you were the horniest straight girl in the East Coast. You know, it's one pudgy looking guy after another. God, did I know what making men look like.
Ivan says he didn't just make a single set of prints. He made a second set, too, for W.H. Sheldon.
We were also sending a copy of each of the pictures to him. And he would occasionally come in to check on things or to whatever he was coming in for. And I have no idea whatever became of that project.
And did it ever seem strange to you that this doctor was getting access to the photos?
No. We weren't as privacy-oriented back then because there weren't as many distributions available. I mean, in those days, if someone had gotten a hold of my posture picture, what the hell would they have done with it? Whereas now, they could post it on Facebook.
Ivan didn't think about the photos for decades. They didn't even come up when he and a friend were recently talking about the strangest jobs they'd ever had.
Only then I listed the odd ones, erecting door frames, selling advertising in foreign technical publications. I never thought of thinking of shooting pictures of naked men. I could end it.
If you've got a story idea, we would love to hear about it. Send us an email at campusfilespod@gmail.com. And if you're loving this podcast, be sure to click follow on your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. While you're there, leave us a review and a 5-star rating. Campus Files is an Odyssey original podcast hosted by Margot Gray and Ian Mont. Our executive producers are Leah Reese-Dennis and Lloyd Lockridge. Campus Files is produced by Ian Mont and Margot Gray. Sound design and engineering by Andy Jaskowitz and Zach Clark. Legal support by Laura Berman and Melissa Jean. Original music by Davey Sumner. Special thanks to Maura Curran, Josephina Francis, Hilary Schuff, Eric Donnelly, Kate Hutchison-Rose, Sean Cherry, Kurt Courtney, and Lauren Vieira.